Moncrief on News Talk.
It is time for the Murder Club, and today Cassie Delaney is going to talk to us about this very weird phenomenon that people become sexually attracted to people who've done the most heinous things.
I promised it to you last week.
Yeah.
These are the stories of awful people who still manage to find love after they've committed their heinous crimes.
Yeah.
It's horrendous. There is a word for it. Hebristophilia. Now, that could be pronounced wrong. It's not really a word that comes up in my day-to-day vernacular. But this is the attraction people feel towards those who've committed appalling crimes. So a lot of men on death row in America routinely get more male than film stars, more male than celebrities. You know, it's incredible. There's whole system set up so that you can contact people on prison. I suppose it's you know, anything's a dating app if you're brave enough.
Yeah.
So we've got a couple. There's obviously, we know Ted Bundy got married when he was in court. There's many, many cases of this, but I have found you three of some of the worst today.
Yeah.
The first one we're going to start with is Richard Ramirez. You'll know him as the Night Stalker. He was born in El Paso in Texas in 1960. And like many killers, he has a tough childhood. He's the youngest of five children. His father was a former policeman turned railway labourer with a temper that was just terrifying. Richard had also incurred a couple of head injuries as a child from a dresser falling on him and from catching a swing in the forehead. And these had resulted in seizures throughout his childhood, but very odd behaviour throughout his life. What really influenced him was his cousin, Mike Ramirez, who was a Green Beret back from Vietnam and just took a shine to Richard and would take him around everywhere. He taught him how to kind of move silently and how to kill, showed him his souvenirs from war, Polaroid photographs of Vietnamese women that he had assaulted and tortured, and with kind of a badge of honour.
Okay, and how old was he?
Richard was only 11 or 12 when he was engaging in all this kind of stuff.
Right.
2 years later, when Richard was just 13 or 14, he was standing with Mike when Mike lost his temper and shot his own wife during an argument. Richard was in the room, standing there as in, you know, covered in blood. Mike was found not guilty by reason of insanity and was out of prison within 4 years.
My word.
Yeah, not a lot of but
Richard,
consequences.
Richard, he's permanently damaged at this point.
Absolutely. Between the swing in the forehead and watching all these violent acts, it's not a normal childhood. And by the 80s, Richard is in LA and he's staying up all night. He's got a drug problem. He's high most of the time. He's breaking into houses to fund himself. And he's convinced that he's doing the devil's work, which is something that he wants to be at and support. Between 84 and 85, he's terrorizing California. There's an interesting thing, a pattern with most serial killers is that they have a type. So they'll go after single women or whatever it is. But Richard didn't have this. He killed anybody and everyone, men, women, children, pensioners. He killed a 79-year-old woman in her bed. He shot a husband dead and gouged out the wife's eyes. Like, his crimes are horrendous. He beat two elderly women with a hammer. And in a lot of the scenes that he was at, he would leave these kind of devil iconography around the place. So pentagrams and the likes, often written in lipstick on the scenes. He would just break in through unlocked windows and go after anyone. He was caught in the end by a fingerprint on a stolen car and a photograph that appeared on the front page of the papers. He was recognized then on the streets in August 1985, and he was actually beaten half to death by ordinary residents who saw him and recognized him. So at trial, he was convicted of 13 murders, 5 attempted murders, 11 sexual assaults and 14 robberies. And when he held up his palm in court, there was a pentagram drawn on it. And he had very little remorse. He basically told prosecutors he'd see them in Disneyland. In the public gallery, it was full of women. Now, the thing about Richard Ramirez, right? He is attractive. He's a good-looking fella. He's got high cheekbones. He's got floppy hair. To many, he will be considered, if you take the crimes aside, he's aesthetically pleasing.
Okay.
One of the women in the gallery watching all the trial proceedings was Doreen Loyoy. And she was 41 from Burbank, a twin, which we have discussed is weird, a graduate and a magazine editor. She'd actually worked on a teen magazine and had worked with celebrities. Like, she worked with John Stamos and was quite a well-known for this work. But the night before Ramirez was arrested, she saw his mugshot in the television on the television, and she said she just saw something in him that she couldn't explain, but she had this inexplicable attraction to him. She wrote him 75 letters.
Oh my God.
And in 1988, he proposed to her. They got married on the 3rd of October 1996 in a ceremony that took only 15 minutes. She wore a short white dress. She bought herself a gold band and gave him a platinum one because apparently Satanists don't like to wear gold. His brother, his sister and his niece came, but nobody from her family came at all. Because her twin sister said it was quite a difficult thing to wrap their head
around. Yeah, yeah.
Not a great time for the family. She was super happy and proud to be his wife. And she visited him regularly, was always near the front of the queue when they were going into visitations. She brought breath mints, so she said, in her own words, kiss with confidence. She was mad about him. Mm. Absolutely. She said he was kind, he was funny, he was her best friend. But she had this line that she always said when people question her about it, and she said that Richard would never hurt children. As if it makes any of the other
different
stuff better.
Yeah.
But this was the kind of, this was her, I suppose her, you know, the line that she wouldn't cross. And for 13 years, she maintained that. But then in 2009, there was a cold case in San Fran where DNA that had been found in the crime scene, and again, DNA advancements, was run through the system again. This was from a case in April 1984 where a 9-year-old girl called Mi Lung had been assaulted, beaten and hanged in the basement of a hotel.
Oh.
Horrendous, horrendous stuff. Richard Ramirez was living in the hotel at the time, and when they ran the DNA, undeniable match, case closed, it was Richard. And that's when Doreen drew the line and stopped visiting and never gave another interview, she never actually filed for divorce. She just kind of disappeared, never to be seen again. Richard managed to get engaged to another woman a couple of years later, but he did die in June 2013 of cancer, having never been executed. So not just one marriage, but two.
That's extraordinary. That's so extraordinary. And you'd wonder what it is. Like, obviously there's a whiff of, well, more than a whiff of danger there, but maybe you can experience that danger, but you're safe from it because
they're in prison.
Up.
They're in prison. But I think maybe it's a case of nobody understands him like I do. And if I can just get through some, it's a bit white savory, you know, like go in and think that you can. And this happens as well. This is kind of the similar story. With
One of her texts says, I was in San Francisco at that time. People were absolutely petrified.
Yeah, because usually when there's a serial killer out, you can walk around and be like, well, I'm not like, you know, a brunette young 25-year-old woman anymore, and I'll be safe from him. But because Richard just was, he was just anyone and everyone could have been a victim. It's terrifying.
Right, yeah. So our next candidate is another serial killer.
Another serial killer, very similar. He's Oscar Ray Boleyn Jr. And he was born in Indiana in 1962 into a family of laborers and carnival workers. That's a red flag. He moved between four states. His father, again, was a very violent man who beat the family. And he ran away, Oscar ran away so often that by his own admission, his mother had to walk him to the school bus on a leash, like those little kid leashes, so kids don't run away. And in 1986, he was responsible for the deaths of three young women. So Natalie Blanche Holly was 25. She was the night manager of a chicken restaurant. And in January that year, she locked up, said goodnight to a colleague, walked to her car about 1:30 in the morning. A jogger found her body the next day. So these women are being, again, viciously assaulted and killed and just discarded. Stephanie Collins was only 17. She vanished in that November. And Terry Lynn Matthews, who was 26 at the time, worked in a bank. In December, she stopped at a post office to collect posts on the way home. She was assaulted, beaten and stabbed to death, and her body was left wrapped in a sheet. So it's like not even just the heinousness of these crimes, it's the total disregard for life and the absolute lack of compassion afterwards, I think, is really jarring here. So for many years, nearly 4 years, these families were left with no answers. And then in 1990, there was a tip line, and the new husband of Boland's ex-wife rang in with a tip. Now, Boland was already in prison in Ohio, serving 22 to 27 years for the kidnap and assault of a 22-year-old waitress. He'd actually held a gun to her head and tried to shoot her, but the gun hadn't gone off, so she'd gotten away. When the tip came in, he was brought back to Florida, tried and convicted and sent to death row. But he kept appealing his convictions. And it, oddly, in this case, his convictions were overturned, retried and overturned again. Over the years, he was tried and found guilty 10 separate times. Kept going at it with the appeals.
Mm.
Then in comes Rosaline Martinez. And this is bonkers. A really fascinating woman. So she was married to a man called Victor Martinez. He was one of the best known attorneys in Tampa. They had 4 daughters, a beautiful house, very wealthy family. They hosted dinner parties with politicians and celebrities. She'd met 3 presidents. This is like the high standing she has in society. But she worked as a mitigation specialist for the public defender's office, which meant her job was to go in and try and find an ounce of humanity in these people.
So she would meet people like him all the time.
All the time. It was her job, day in, day out. And her job was to basically put a case in front of a jury that explained maybe their reasonings or humanized them somewhat to lessen their sentences. And in 1995, she was handed the Bolin file. She went out to meet him and a guard actually warned her as she was going in to meet him that this guy was a convicted serial killer and he was bad news. But she said that she looked into his eyes and of the thousands of killers that she had met, she had always seen a darkness and a toxicity, but that Bolin just didn't have it, that it wasn't there. And she ended up sitting down the edge of his bed and stayed with him for 8 hours. She ordered all the case files and they arrived in dozens of boxes. She started visiting every day and became utterly convinced that he was innocent. Her marriage...
Of everything.
Of everything. And he's been convicted multiple times, bear in mind. This has gone to court 10 times. He's tried to prove his innocence and 10 separate occasions he's been proven guilty. So there must be a significant amount of evidence against him. Obviously, her marriage starts to fall apart. Dinner parties are over and she grows closer and closer to Bolin. She ends up leaving her husband and even in the settlement gives up custody of her 4 daughters. On the 5th of October 1996, then, Rosaline puts on a white bridal gown and she gets married in her own apartment over a speakerphone. But he's 3 hours away in a cell. There's just a photograph of him in the room to stand in for him. The American program 2020 filmed the entire thing and broadcast it. And Florida was gripped watching this woman marry a serial killer. But she had said that it was not just for love that she had done it. She thought that if she became his wife, that there'd be some sort of borrowed status in her kind of standing and that people might be more willing to take him seriously, that they would listen to his story. But just 3 days after their wedding, Oscar Bolin was sentenced to death again. So she spent the next 20 years fighting. She retrained as a licensed private investigator and became one of the most outspoken opponents of the death penalty in the state. She got so good, they said, at pulling kind of last minute stays out of nowhere that Catherine Reeves, who was the mother of Terry Lynn Matthews, one of Bolin's victims, said that she always braced herself for Rosaline to produce another rabbit out of the hat as it came close to any death, death sentence or execution. So the same mother, when the death warrant was finally signed in October 2015, went to her daughter's grave on what would have been Terry's 55th birthday and she brought flowers and rolled up inside the bouquet was the warrant. And she said this was the last thing she could have done for her daughter. On the 7th of January 2016, Rosaline visited her husband from 8 until 11 that morning. The evening the execution was held for 4 hours, it was held up for 4 hours while the Supreme Court considered a final appeal, but they refused it. And when asked if he had any last words, Oscar Ray Rollin said no, sir, and he was pronounced dead 16 minutes later.
And so she believed right until the end.
Never
that this guy was innocent, and presumably still alive today, and somewhere in the world.
I wonder, did she get remarried? I'll check that one out.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, when do you bring that up? Is that a third date kind of a conversation?
Why did your last relationship not work out? Yeah, you're not supposed to mention your exes on dates.
No, or ever in that case. Now, just to flip it a bit, this happens to women who are incarcerated as
women,
well.
Women thriving in male-dominated fields. We love to see it. This is one of the Manson girls. So Susan Atkins is born in California in 1948. Again, a kind of traumatic childhood. Her mother died of cancer when Susan was 15 and the family fell apart. So she ends up drifting and going to San Fran. Took a load of drugs. And I mean, we're in the kind of 60s, so a lot of acid. And she ended up working as a dancer in a stage show run by Anton LaVey, who was the founder of the Church of Satan. And in that kind of nightclub dance area, she's playing a vampire. So a lot of, again, okay. a lot of satanistic iconography and a sort of appeal to that way of living. In 1967, she meets Charles Manson, which, as people will know, didn't really work out well for yeah. many people. She changes her name to Sadie Mae Glutz. And on the night of August 8th, 1969, she is one of the Manson followers and the Manson family who goes into CeeLo Drive in LA with three others. And inside is Sharon Tate, who's 8.5 months pregnant, Jay Sebring, Abigail Folger and Walchuk. Stephen Parent, who is 18, is shot on the driveway on the way out. Atkins is the one who holds Sharon Tate down, and Sharon Tate is begging for mercy because she knows that she's pregnant. And Atkins says in her own plain words that she actually got sick of listening to the begging and decided to just kill Sharon. And she wrote the word pig in Sharon's blood on her front door on the way out. So again, blatant disregard for life. Very, very heinous crimes. She's convicted of 8 murders in total and sentenced to death in 1971. But that was commuted to life following the following year because California's death penalty was struck down. But in 1981, at the age of 33, she gets married. Her groom is mental. Yeah. He's absolutely, like none of what this man says is true.
Yeah.
He's a 52-year-old Texan called Donald Lee Lazier, who signs his name with a dollar sign instead
class.
Of an S.
Pure class.
Yeah. Susan was his 29th wife, but apparently the only woman he actually ever loved. He claimed to be an oil millionaire worth $999 million. And he said he had 7 times that amount of money abroad. He was extremely vague about where any of his wealth came from. And he drove a Cadillac with a sign on it reading filthy rich. So a humble man. He said they had met on a Californian motorway in 1965 when Susan had pulled up beside him in a Corvette and told him he was beautiful. He said they had stayed in contact and that he had the backing of 40 United States senators for a clemency appeal to President Reagan. And he said that he would spend $50 million on getting her out. And until then, he would build a $12 million solar-powered house near the prison to wait for her.
Did he say all this to her? Or this
he's
was
saying
telling
this
people?
Everywhere. He's yeah. in the press. He's a mad character. She walks down the chapel in a $6,000 satin gown that he had designed himself and sewn by a woman in New Jersey. I mean, none of the details of this wedding seem appealing in any way. He was waiting at the altar in, wait for it, an orange leisure suit. Like I'm thinking like a velour juicy couture tracksuit.
Yeah.
A cowboy hat, a giant gold belt buckle and a fistful of diamond rings. And he told the press that a wedding gift had arrived from his good friend Fidel Castro. So he's just mental. A sheriff spokesperson described him as harmless, but with an outrageous imagination, which I think seems
okay,
pretty
that's kind. Yeah.
Yeah. 2 weeks later, Susan Atkins is at a parole hearing and her new husband, who had vowed to spend millions freeing her, did not attend. And he never actually made contact with the lawyer at all. So her parole was denied. The marriage only lasted about a year because Lazier wrote to a television reporter claiming that his wife had stabbed him during a prison visit when she saw him talking to Leslie Van Outen in the visiting room, another person. So the prosecutor took that letter to the parole hearing and she was given extra time for the apparent stabbing. But she still married again. In 1987, this time to a lawyer called James Whitehouse, who was 15 years younger than her and went on to represent her at every parole hearing she ever had. That marriage lasted 22 years until the day that she died.
My word.
Yeah. Now, it's kind of, again, we take her crimes out of it. There is a touch, an element, a slight little snippet of romance here in the end because he was very committed to her.
Mm.
By 2009, she had terminal brain cancer. She had one leg amputated. One side was completely paralyzed. And even the prosecutor had put her away, said the state should show her a little bit of mercy in her final months. So in September of 2009, she was wheeled into a parole hearing on a gurney and she slept through most of the hearing. But her husband, that young fellow, he wasn't young anymore, stayed by her side and they read through some psalms and she kind of woke up long enough to join in at the end with them. Deborah Tate, who was Sharon's sister, told the parole board that her nephew should have been 40 years old that year. So parole ultimately was refused and Susan Atkins died in prison 22 days later. She was the longest serving woman in the Californian system.
What an extraordinary story.
Yeah, so not just some marriages, multiple marriages for many murderers.
Yeah. Cassie, thanks a million. As ever, Cassie Delaney there.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.